Can you hear me? I'm an addict. My name is Eric. Thank you for such a lovely introduction. This is my first time as a main speaker, and I want to thank everyone that was involved, and I'm very grateful to this area for picking me out of the many people that were to be picked from. And Shani, thank you very much. This is a great camp out, and there's a lot more people here than I thought there were going to be. Thank you, my wife, for introducing me again. I was humbled by some of the things that you said. You're very gracious. So I got clean in the late 80s. I tried to go to NA in Asheville, North Carolina. I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. The first meeting I went to was probably in like 1985 or so. And I thought it would be a great way for me to stop smoking weed. And my wife at the time thought so too. She was working in a treatment center area. It was like a psychiatric hospital, and on her smoke break, she used to talk to a guy named Keith, and he was in treatment, and he would tell her about the program of NA, and that's how I first got introduced, because I met Keith when he got out at a meeting, and he took me in to this meeting. And my first impression was like, not at all what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be people wearing like three-piece suits with shiny black shoes, and it wasn't like that at all. It was very humbling. It was more like people were very familiar with each other. They knew each other, and they all got along with each other and were giving each other hugs and laughing, and I was completely perplexed and went in one ear and out the other. I wasn't ready to surrender at that time. Fast forward my life about 2 years, I came and hit a bottom. My wife at the time said that I needed to do something or she's going to get out of the relationship. And so they did an intervention on me, and I went into my first rehab. My story has a relapse in it, and relapse is a part of my story. I went to treatment. It was the first time I was clean since I was seven, for 30 days. My story started very early. My parents were from Boston. I'm originally from the Cambridge, Massachusetts area, in New York, Long Island, and I grew up in a commune. There was lots of people in the family, and we all used to hang out, and I was that hippie kid. You know what hippie kids do. We do what everything our parents do, and I like to smoke pot, and I like to, you know, smoke that pipe going around the circle after dinner time and jump up and down on my bed and say, I love this. It feels so good. And I did that not knowing that anything was wrong. It was part of the culture. It was something I liked to do. It was what I did. And so all of my life, I just wanted more. I you know, used that for a long time, and then I got into other things. So the first time I was in treatment, it was the first time I was actually clean off of any kind of like chemical substances since I was like 6 or 7 years old. And I was grateful. I was happy. It seemed like everything was good. But part of the core of my disease is not being able to be honest with myself and express that to other people. So when I got out, I literally had a stash in my pickup truck, and about 2 weeks later I found it and grabbed it and used again. I was in the bathroom in my house, and I was at that moment where I had the toilet seat and I was gonna flush it down the toilet, and I was wrestling in my mind, like, am I gonna do it or not? And I ended up just doing it because I justified in my head that, well, no one's gonna know, no one's gonna know anything. And it was the first time I got in touch with the progressiveness of the disease of addiction. As soon as I did that drug, it was this wave of shame and guilt that came over my body. I was so ashamed and fearful for myself that I'd done something really wrong. And I wanted more. I wanted another hit. I couldn't get enough of that hit. I kept trying to get more. And as soon as I got a wad of money in my hand, I went out and tried to get as much as I could. And I started doing that drug in a different way. It was more dangerous. And then I came home, and all the doors or the lock, my key didn't work anymore in the house. And she was getting better. She was going to Narnon and getting help, and she locked me out of the house. And I had my pickup truck. So there I am with my pickup truck running around, and I decided to go into treatment again. I stayed clean for about 6 months. In Asheville at the time, they had several meetings, one every day called the Silver Door. And there was meetings at nighttime, lots of people in recovery. It was a very well-established group of recovering addicts. And I'm very grateful to them. They always welcomed me, no matter how many times I picked up a white chip. We had white chips back then. And I picked them up over and over again. And they kept welcoming me. One guy named Bob, he used to say, tell me what it's like out there. I want to know, because if it's so great, I'm going to go out there with you. I said, no, Bob, it's not any good. That's why I'm here humbling myself, trying to pick up a white chip again. And then Bob would say, well, I just want to know, you know. He'd keep coming around me like a puppy dog. Tell me what it's like out there. And I'd say, no, please, please, get away from me. And they just kept coming at me no matter how I resisted. I didn't know how to accept love from the fellowship. And I was always going out and coming back, going out and coming back. And when I got out of treatment for the second time, I get in to a situation where I have a roommate in recovery, and he's a biker, and we're I'm clean for about almost 6 months. And then that urge got into my head again. I had this reservation, and I thought it would be a good idea to take $17 off of his dresser and go see if I could find anything to use. Well, he didn't think that was a really good idea at all. And he kicked my ass out on the street and showed up to the meeting when I went to go pick up my white chip again with a switchblade in the meeting, you know, cleaning his fingernails while looking at me the whole time. And I had to do that. I had to humble and humiliate myself. It was a hard thing to do. This went on for about 3 or 4 years, and I found myself in a place of misery. I felt like I was a loser. I was a lonely addict who nobody could help. I wasn't able to get clean. And what's the use? What's the use to live anymore? And these are the types of conversations I had in my head. But I kept going to meetings no matter what. I would go to a meeting. I thought, well, maybe I get some osmosis from you people, you know, from everybody in the meeting. Like, maybe this stuff would absorb in my brain somehow, and I would somehow magically be cured. But I wasn't surrendering. And surrendering came hard to me. I had to get myself into situations in order for me to get slapped around a little bit before I would let go. And one of those situations was I was in a dope man's house with his girlfriend using, and I'm like pacing back and forth, you know, I'm like looking on the floor for more rocks. I'm like crawling in the carpet, looking out the window. I'm a nutcase. I'm like an animal, a rabid animal. And I hear helicopters coming. I hear the police coming. I hear everybody's coming, the troops, the cavalry. I hear dogs, you know, everything, every sound is like hypersensitive in my body. And, you know, anybody ever had that feeling before? Yeah. It was crazy. And the guy's like freaked out by me. He's like, man, you're all geeked up. You need to get the hell out of my place. You know, here's your stash. Here's your bag. You know, please just go. And I'm like, what? You're kicking me out? Yeah. Here, I don't care. Here's your stuff. Just go. Get out of here. So I have to go down my pickup truck, which is parked down this hill, and because I was too paranoid to park over there. So I'm like, I get out of the apartment, the building, and I look down. About 3 buildings down, there's this woman pointing to me. And I'm like, oh, do I know you? And I said, no, I don't know her. And she's just pointing at me, and 3 grown men start running behind her after me. And I said in my head, I knew that was the police. It has to be. It's got, you know, they're running after me, and I'm like getting ready to put my hands up, but I noticed that they don't have any badges. They don't have any guns. They're not in outfits. I said, no, they're here to rob me. And so I'm like, I got to jack off and run down the hill while they're chasing after me. It's like cop and robber stuff, except that they're not cops. I don't know who they are. They just wanted to get after me. And maybe they don't like the neighbors, you know. It could be one of those situations, like neighborhood gone wrong, and I'm the one, I'm it. And I got down the hill, and I'm trying to fumble in my pocket to get the key while I'm running. I threw all my stuff out in the weeds, and I'm shaking really bad, trying to open the door, and I get the door open, and I jump in the car, and the guy's hand grabs the door. And we're wrestling back and forth with the door, and I finally get it shut and lock it. And on the hood of my pickup truck is a guy with a big rock, and he's bashing in my windshield. And on the back, another guy's bashing in the window, and everybody's trying to break my window. And I just start the pickup truck and take off. And everybody goes all over the pavement, and I'm thinking in my head in slow motion, God, what is going on here? And the other thing I'm thinking of is, this shit's too much work. Using is not fun anymore. It's like work. And I'm running around trying to figure out how to do this stuff, and it's not fun anymore. It doesn't feel good anymore. And I don't get the hit that I was looking for anymore. And I go up in the neighborhood, and I'm praying. I said, please help me get out of this situation. I don't know who those people are. And I come back down out of the neighborhood, and there are the police. And they got me all surrounded, and you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, raise my hands up, and they have guns in my head, and I have to unlock the door. It's one of those moments like, you know, you want to lower your hand and unlock the door. You don't know if you should lower your hand because they might think you have a weapon. And I get the door open, and they yank me out, slap the handcuffs on me, and say, you're under arrest. I said, for what? I thought I was expecting to hear something about drugs. They said something I was completely unexpectedly hearing. They said, you're a suspect for rape. I said, rape? And I just kept my mouth shut. They took me uptown and put me in a room with those detectives that knew me from robbing my business of, you know, that I worked at and stealing from Kmart. And they had all these charges on me. And they put me in a room with a dial-up phone. This is before cell phones, folks. You know, if you're like on a cell phone right now, we didn't have that luxury back then, you know. There was no calling your alibi or any of that stuff, you know. They had, you know, there was just a dial-up phone and a tape recorder, those cassette recorders, you know, that you might have seen in your grandparents' closet somewhere locked away. So we had that on the table, and they asked me, you know, so what did you do? How did you rape this girl? I said, what are you talking about? I didn't rape anybody. He said, we can cut you a deal. You know, all those other charges you're facing, we can just wrap that up in one nice package and say, we'll just do the rape charge and we'll throw all the other stuff away. I said, I didn't rape anybody. I said, okay, yeah, whatever. And the thoughts that are going in my head is, God, please help me. They're not going to believe anything I say because I'm an addict. And they know it. They got me. And I'm going to go to jail for something I didn't do, and I'm innocent of those charges. But I got myself in this situation because that's what we do. We get ourselves in these situations. No one else did that for me. I got myself in that situation. You know, but it sounds like some forces out there were having a fun time with me trying to get my attention, is what was going on, is how I took it. And they came back after I was sweating in the room for an hour, and they said, okay, let's talk about this rape again. I asked them, when did this rape supposedly occur? And they told me, like, something like a Wednesday. I don't remember exactly, but I do remember the time. They said it was 12:30 in the afternoon. It was a Monday through Friday day. And guess where I was on Monday through Friday in the afternoon? I was at the Nooner, the Silver Door Group in Asheville, North Carolina. Just put a plug in for them. They still meet today, by the way. And they said, really? That's a good one. You're in a meeting of NA. Oh, okay, that's a real good one. And for some reason, I put my hand in my pocket because I was fidgeting around. I was all nervous and everything. And I had a piece of paper in my pocket. And the piece of paper, I pulled it out and said, what the heck is this? It was an NA meeting list from Asheville. And it had on the back of it, you know, those phone numbers that we asked, you know, newcomers to put all the guys' names on there. I had that meeting list in my pocket. That one, the one that I never used, you know? And that was in my face, and I handed it to the detective. I said, call them. And the first number they called in front of me, two rings, answers the phone at his house in the middle of the afternoon, I guess. And he answered the phone. It wasn't a cell phone. He was at his house. What are the odds? You know, remember the old days when you had to check your messages? So he answers. The next time, the phone rings again. That other person answers. The third time, the other person answers. And they said, this is something wrong here. So we'll be back. And they go and they go talk to, I guess, the group of people. They come back and they said, that young lady that accused you of raping her, she's recanted her whole story. She made it up completely. She told her three brothers that I raped her because of some kind of problem that she was having, and she was trying to use me as a diversion. I was a diversion for the three brothers who were going to kill me. That's how I took that. But I happened to be walking out at that very moment in time, and she pointed me out at that very moment. And guess who was my alibi? Narcotics Anonymous was my alibi. And I couldn't believe it. It was like, I still get like chicken skin when I think about this stuff, because no one can make this up. I thought it was God. I thought God was helping me. And Narcotics Anonymous was the reason why. And I said, okay, God, I get it now. I'm supposed to go to meetings and surrender and get clean. And, you know, the other thing I took from that is, like, my only advice I'm going to give to you is, if you are a newcomer, there are any newcomers, raise your hands. Get a meeting list. Use those numbers. You never know what you might need the numbers for. But use them numbers, because you never know. And so that was my bottom. I surrendered that point, and I got myself into the last treatment center that I went to, and I stayed clean since then. That was February 9th, 1989. That was just the beginning of my journey, however. I was in treatment, and I met a lady. She was an old AA broad, and she was real crusty and very tough love, and she said, I know this guy in Atlanta, and he's an NA guy, and he's been around for a long time, and he's running a halfway house. You've never done halfway house before. You've lost your marriage. You've lost your jobs. You've lost the respect of all the people in your family. And I don't believe in geographical cures, but I think this might be a good idea for you. Why don't you go to Atlanta? And so I did. And before I went to Atlanta, someone had to drive me to Atlanta, and my father came into the picture. My father was living in Los Angeles, and he was worried about me, and he flew in, picked me up from treatment, and drove me to Atlanta. And we had... you know, I had a troubling childhood, and it was a wonderful thing, because my dad loved me enough, even in spite of all of our history and all of our past, to that effort to bring me to Atlanta. And I knew when I'd surrendered, I had no desire to use again. I wanted to get away from that lifestyle. I wanted to get away from those people that I'd used with. I wanted to get away from all of that. I had surrendered completely. And I went into Atlanta, and the guy that was running the halfway house, his name's Cecil Lackey. He's no longer living, so I can break his anonymity. He had 25 years clean in Narcotics Anonymous back then. And he ran a boot camp. It was like, get up at 6 in the morning, clean everything. I'm going to inspect it, you know, make breakfast, clean up, and we'll have group. And by the way, Eric, I noticed you're not doing outpatient, so you need to make a job out of finding. You need to make a job out of finding a job. And I suggest that you go up the highway. I said, no, sir. I know I'm a chef by trade. I can find a job easily in Atlanta. He said, I forgot to tell you, you're not allowed to work in a place that serves alcohol. I said, what? How dare you? How, you know, still the reservation that I can be around booze. He said, I suggest you just go walk up Buford Highway until you find a job. So I'll see you in 8 hours. If you haven't found a job, come back in 8 hours. I went up Buford Highway on foot, knocking on doors, telling him my situation. I live in a halfway house. He told me to be honest about all that stuff. Tell him I'm on probation. And I got hired by Taco Bell the same day. You know? And it was a great experience for me. It's exactly where I needed to be. You know, I see a lot of people that come new in recovery, you know, they're very accomplished in carpentry or mechanics or, you know, engineering. You know, we're smart people. And I see people, you know, they want to get that job and you know, all of a sudden they're working like 6 days a week and, you know, all the meetings, you know, I needed to work in Taco Bell. I got there in the morning. It was an 8-hour shift. It paid minimum wage. I came back. We had group. We went to a meeting, went to bed, and I did it all over again day after day after day after day after day. I stayed there for a year. I never missed a day of work. I took the bus. I was ready. I was willing. I was teachable. And I did what people were telling me to do because I didn't know anything. And that's how it was when I was back then. And NA, they had meetings scattered all over the place. Sometimes I went to meetings in the other fellowship. It was very kind, you know. They helped me a lot in early recovery. And so I stopped working at Taco Bell, and I had gotten a roommate from the fellowship, and I started working in a place that served alcohol. Well, it turned out that the chef I was working with was in recovery. 10 years in the other fellowship, I found out by accident. And he told me, don't you ever break my anonymity. Don't tell anybody I'm in the program. But I knew that God was watching out. You know, when we open there's a saying in recovery, it says that, you know, when I have willingness and I open my heart and I embrace this fellowship, that the doors of recovery open all around me. And the energy that it creates puts positive people in your lives that help you and want to watch out for you. And that person did. I got to work with someone in recovery. And I got to take his inventory, and I got to talk about him, and I got to say, man, you're not a good chef. Or, you know, I had all these judgments and stuff, and I got to work all that out with him. And he got to slam food in my face and say, listen, you didn't do that right. You need to fix it. You know, you're just a line cook. I'm the chef. So we had all that going on too. And it was a great experience. It was like life on life's terms. You know, I got 2 years clean one time. He said, damn, you're almost well enough to make coffee. You know, he's well enough to make coffee. How dare you tell me that? I'm Mr. Recovery. I go to meetings all the time. He said, just go sit your ass down and go make some coffee. That's how it was back then, you know, and maybe I needed some of that. Well, at that same place, I saw this beautiful South American, first time I ever was around like a lot of Spanish people and all these exotic women, and I see this woman working in this kitchen that I'm at, and I was like, you know, clean and full of hormones, and you know how it is when you get clean, you know, you want to test yourself and see if you got anything left, you know, and I see this beautiful young woman who's working there too, and I said something to her, and she's like, huh? You know? And it turns out that she became my wife, the love of my life. And so we started talking to each other, and she had a translation. She had a, you know, we didn't have cell phones. We had a book, you know, Spanish, English, and we were doing that, and I was going to meetings, and then, you know, we got to be closer to each other, and then, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a recovering addict. Oh, that went over really well. So I kind of went into it backwards. You know, there's no right or wrong way. We hear about in recovery, don't get involved in a major relationship until you have done a fifth step. I did all that wrong. There's no rhyme or reason to love, though. And so I went into it backwards. And I had a lot of work to do, and we both did. And I struggled, and we managed to put together a family. We had a son and a daughter. Some of the happiest times of my life. I got to go to another country for the first time. That was amazing. You know, I go down to Peru. I go down to an area called Cusco, and I flew in there, and I saw like people who don't have like the privileges and the commodities that we do, maybe, but the spirit was there. A guy, you know, I get out of the airplane, I'm looking for a taxi, this guy grabs my suitcases for me, and he's speaking in a very light voice, and it humbled me. He was so happy, and I cried. I couldn't believe how happy he was, and to see people in other countries, maybe with less than what we have, and to be so happy, and I was humbled. I also went to an NA meeting in Peru. It was a great experience. So I got to travel, and we got to have a family. And I kept going to meetings. And I kept not working steps. Guess what happens when you don't work steps? Well, usually, you know, I don't start out my day by prayer. I usually start out my day by, like, looking at porno. Guess how your day is going to go then? Well, if you start your day walking porno, you're probably going to be like all edgy and crazy the whole day and, you know, wanting more or whatever. Well, that was a part of my disease too. And I struggled with that back and forth, like trying to, you know, make that other hit work. And so that can be just as destructive as the drug that I was using. And that's part of my story too. And, you know, I had to work steps on that. I had to get honest with it. I had to walk through that. And it was very painful. And I got onto the other side of that. So, you know, it says, I think, in the basic text in step one or in the beginning somewhere that, you know, drugs were not just a symptom of our disease, but drugs were not my disease totally, but they're just a symptom of my disease, meaning that there are lots of other things that I can act out on if I don't take care of me. You know, and why was I not taking care of me? You know, why didn't I love myself? Why wasn't I thinking that I can be successful? I can be a positive influence on other people's lives, and including myself. I can take care of myself. And I can exercise and eat right and pray and go to work and be kind to my family. Why was I not capable of doing that? And that's some of the core issues that I had to deal with, and I discovered by doing an inventory that maybe there were some things I needed to work on and have some. I had a lot of resentments against my mom. I wasn't raised by my mother, so I had some mommy issues, you know? My first chunk of my childhood was a little bit crazy, I guess, for lack of a better name. We were living in Long Island at the time, and I had a lot of resentments because I was abandoned by my mother. My dad got arrested, God bless his soul, for selling something that the FBI thought would be a good idea to have him arrested for. And we were stuck with our mother. I have a brother. And so we were living with our mom, who was, you know, unfortunately high as a kite on some of those drugs and was having a struggle with trying to take care of us. And we went to the park in Long Island, and she thought it was a good idea to go say, I'll be back in a few. Can you watch us? The neighbors, you know, parents were watching us over us in the park. And it kept going on the day we were playing and stuff, but we realized that our mother wasn't there. And we were like wondering, where's our mom? And we were starting to cry and stuff, I guess. And the people that were watching us were wondering what was going on. And a policeman came up. I guess they called the police, and policeman came and picked us up because our mother never came back. She left us in the park. And, you know, a lot of things could have gone wrong about that situation, you know, but thank goodness the people that were watching us, you know, called the police and had us picked up. And they figured out who we were and took us to her parents' house, And they were really pissed off at my dad. And he had his reasons or whatever, but he decided to put us in the foster care. He didn't want to take care of us. He's an upper middle class pilot in Long Island and didn't want anything to do with us and threw us to the state. So my brother and I got the honor and privilege of living in a foster home for 2 years. And we never saw our mother except for one time, and that was like the last time I saw my mother for my entire life except for when I was like 15. And so I guess I always wanted to be a people pleaser. Like, you know, if I meet you in person, I want to make things right. I don't want to have any waves. And I had this deep-rooted, like, resentment against my mom, and I had to forgive her. So that's something that I learned how to do in recovery, is she was on my, you know, list. And I had to learn how to forgive my mother for leaving me in the park when I was a kid. It was hard to do because I thought, I'm not good enough for you. My grandparents don't think I'm good enough for me, you know, that I'm not good enough for them. Nobody wants me. You know, I must be like a terrible person. And I was only 5 years old when this happened. You know, and I had to learn how to find some love inside my heart to love myself because I didn't think I was lovable. And so I had to transcend some of that stuff and learn how to love myself. And that's, you know, I had, you know, to do nice things for myself, to take care of myself, and it's still an ongoing process. And she passed away last October. I had been sporadically in touch with her, and she was in a place in California. We tried to invite her to our family several times, and she didn't want to come. So it is what it is. There's nothing I could do about it. And that's the thing in recovery is, like, I have to learn how to forgive and move on and live in today, you know? One of the things that came out of that experience was that I know that I'm a child of God and I deserve to be here. And that I can, you know, and being involved with Narcotics Anonymous, I've done service work and helping other people, trying to sponsor people and being of service, you know, whether I'm, you know, of course I'm the chef, right? So I've done a lot of NA cooking events to the point it's gotten to be a little ridiculous, you know? And so I hope that some bellies are happy for that. And I've carried the message in H&I and to a treatment facility out in Culpeper. I do that, and I try to work with people. You know, we have to find balance in our life because, you know, I'm married to someone who's not in Narcotics Anonymous. Of course, she has her own fellowship, but you have to find balance in your life, you know. And I can do some for NA, and I can do some for my family. But, you know, basically, charity begins at home. The other thing was that I wanted to share with you is one of the things I learned in recovery, too, recently about, you know, within the last few years is that, of course, we all know this great truth, the world is not fair. I remember a teacher writing it on the chalkboard, life is not fair. And it's true, though. You know, life is not fair. There's suffering going on in the world. There's people who are at war with each other and people who are fighting for their lives. There's slavery in Congo to give us our cell phones. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on in the world. And you know, I can walk out and someone might hit me in my car or I might get fired from a job. I might have to confront somebody at work. There could be other troubles, like on little small scales in my fellowship. There could be different types of issues, and sometimes it seems like life is not fair. And through the process of recovery, I've learned how to transcend that and realize that I can accept that life is not fair, and it makes it easier to deal with life on a daily basis. That it's okay, I can roll with the waves, you know? Life is not fair. There's opportunities to change and improve. And, you know, in recovery, I also need to have discipline. It's something I didn't learn very well early in recovery, but, you know, discipline means delaying gratification. I remember there was a member in Asheville, North Carolina. He used to tell me that I need to learn how to delay gratification. I can't have my cake first. I need to do the work first and then have it later as a reward. It, you know, it's kind of like going on a beautiful hike in the mountains, and then you're rewarded with this beautiful view. And, you know, that's a hard way to, you know, sometimes it feels good, though, to delay gratification and not just get your pie and eat it in first and reap the rewards first. It's better to hold on to it later. Let me see how I'm doing for time here. Okay, wow. I talk about myself a lot. Okay, I got like 5 minutes. Okay, well, because I'm a chef, you're not going to get out of this. You know, I love food and I love to cook. And one of the things that I think is wonderful in the food that I do, you know, like being a chef is like being in recovery. Let me put it that way. So like say you work in a restaurant. There's a lot of moving pieces that come around. Like I call it the people in the fellowship. It could be the people in my kitchen. You know, one person may be working on an appetizer while another person's making a sauce during the day that you use at night. Another person may be purchasing food that you need to have in your kitchen. So there's a lot of moving pieces for that final plate that comes in your table, you know. And also, usually the best food, my best recovery has been slow cooked. You know, you might have, if you like Mexican food, mole would be a great example of that. Now, mole has like several ingredients. You need to have chocolate, you have to have sesame seeds, there's fruit involved, tomatoes, garlic, onions, there's almonds, and it's all ground up, and you have to sear the meat. Like say it's chicken mole, you're going to sear the meat, and then you're going to cook it slowly in that sauce and let it simmer all afternoon. And then it's going to be really delicious, but you can't rush it. Like in recovery, you can't rush the job. You know, you got to, some things just take time and perseverance and consistency. So you got that mole working all afternoon, and then maybe the appetizer is a little simpler. It might be like ceviche or something, marinated shrimp, you know, with some lime juice, and it's nice and fresh and hot. Well, that's kind of like my early recovery, nice and fresh and hot. And then you can have like the dessert. You know, it may take a while to make a chocolate pie, maybe Mexican style with a little cinnamon, a little spice in there. And you have to let it cool down. But you have to wait. You can't just take your finger in the pie and take a big bite of it first. You got to wait, have it on the sidelines for dessert. So we get and we sit down. We have this big recovery feast together. And we get to enjoy that spicy ceviche. It's really good and refreshing. And then we get the richness of what it means to take time in your recovery, that mole sauce, all that energy went into it. And we get to enjoy that mole. It's all rich and exotic. And then we get to have our chocolate pie and eat it too, right? And that's how recovery is. It's a process. It's a journey. It doesn't take time. It can't be rushed. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And thank you, Narcotics Anonymous, for making this happen for me. And I'm really blessed to have a wonderful wife and family. My children are healthy. God bless. And something that we do, too, together is we pray together. Something that I haven't done in a while is sit down and pray. It really has helped our relationship a lot. And it helps me, instead of starting out my day with porno, I can start out my day with prayer. And guess what happens? It changes my whole day completely. And thanks for letting me share.